This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kevin Spacey, has a new movie opening next month called The Life of David Gale. Spacey won Academy Awards for his performances in American Beauty and The Usual Suspects. His other films include Glengarry Glen Ross, Swimming with Sharks, Seven, L.A. Confidential, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, The Negotiator, Pay It Forward, K-Pax, and The Shipping News. Before we talk about his approach to acting and some of the early turning points of his life, let's hear about his new film, The Life of David Gale. Spacey plays David Gale, a professor in Austin, Texas, who is an anti-death penalty activist and has worked closely with an activist played by Laura Linney. But after years of fighting against the death penalty, David Gale is now on death row, facing imminent execution. Insisting he's been framed, he asks a reporter, played by Kate Winslet, to meet him in prison so that he can tell her his real story in the hopes that she'll write an investigative piece that will uncover facts which will prove he's not a murderer. This is the scene in which they meet in prison for the first time.
Someone's framing you?
Oh, it's more than that. There was a tripod.
Right. Facing her body. Back on the record?
Yes. The tripod had no fingerprints on it. That means that somebody brought it there, set it up, wiped it clean, and left it. Why? It's as if they wanted me to know that somewhere out there is a record of exactly what happened that afternoon. As if they wanted me to die, knowing that the key to my freedom is out there somewhere.
Maybe you're being paranoid.
Miss Bloom, I used to be this state's leading death penalty abolitionist, and now I'm on death row. Doesn't that strike you as a little odd?
Without giving away anything that happens in the story, there are a lot of surprising twists, and your impressions of the characters are changed as the movie progresses. And I guess I'm wondering what you think the movie says about the death penalty, pro or con.
I don't really care. I didn't take the movie because I have some, you know,
I was wondering
dog
about
in
that.
This fight.
No, I was wondering if you.
No, I took the movie because mm-hmm. I think that, first of all, I wanted the chance to work with Alan Parker, mm-hmm. whose work, particularly if you look at his work in films like Mississippi Burning or Midnight Express, even The Commitments, any time that he has a political center to a film, he manages to do this rather remarkable thing, which is to subverse it, which is to have it underneath. And although the death penalty is it's not the single issue in the film, there's a couple of other issues as well. I think that what he manages to do and what we were hoping to do was to take an issue that's a really hot-button issue and that divides people, creates a lot of polarization, and turn it into something human. That by following characters and trying to understand what motivates them in their choices, not just around that issue, but their choices in their lives, it's less easy to dismiss an argument when you get to know the person who's making it. I mean, look at what happens a lot when we watch sort of debates, you know, television, the far right, the far left, you know. It's almost as if when a person declares their position on something, nobody listens to what they have to say anymore. Because, oh, we know what your argument's going to be. I'd be curious to know this. If people knew at the beginning of the movie the choices that the characters make that they know at the end of the film, would they be as open to them as people, and would they follow, and I hope invest themselves emotionally in these characters' lives as much? Because there is this great, as you indicate, sort of you keep getting surprised by events, and I think that your relationship and your moral stance about characters and their choices shifts through the film. Ultimately, I'm not the person who can even sort of say what the statement is because I didn't make the movie, in the sense that it's Alan Parker and Charles Randolph who are the filmmakers. You know, I'm an element and I serve a function in the film. And frankly, I always try to avoid sort of telling an audience what I think they ought to get out of a movie. You know, it's so much more important to hear what someone else feels about what you've done.
Before we talk about some of your other films, I want to ask you about your new website, which is TriggerStreet.com, which is also the name without the .com of your production company. And this is your way of trying to give opportunities to young would-be filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit what you're doing with this website.
When I look at my own career, I am quick to realize that without first-time, second-time writers, directors, playwrights, I wouldn't have a career. That it's been very often my experience where I've taken chances on people who hadn't yet proved themselves, and they took chances on me.
Mm-hmm.
But then, okay, now those movies all did really well, and suddenly I become a well-known person, and I'm doing well, and I'm making movies, except I get cut off from an entire pipeline of talent because now you can't accept unsolicited material because of all the potential legal ramifications of, you know, you open that package that comes to your office. It could be the next fat Greek wedding, but you can't open it.
Why not?
Because you can get sued.
By who?
Let's say, we live in a very litigious society.
Well, I knew that.
Someone can say that someone who knew someone who knew someone who knew a security guard at the Fox lot stole their idea that they wrote originally 10 years ago.
Oh.
So if you reject the film or the screenplay that comes to your office, and 5 years later somebody makes a movie that's kind of like that idea, you're open to a lawsuit, and it happens all the time.
I see.
Now, okay, so that's an unfortunate reality.
Right.
But how do we break that down? And is there a way to break that wall down? Because frankly, I don't want to lose a pipeline to that kind of invigorating, interesting. You know, a lot of people in Hollywood talk about thinking out of the box, but they don't really do it. I mean, they don't really find practical ways to do it. Secondly, what's happened is if you just look at who represents directors and writers who are starting out. I mean, if you think it's hard for an actor to get a job, imagine what it's like if you're a director. Well, a lot of the agencies that used to focus specifically on nurturing undeveloped talent have folded in the last 10 years. They can't compete. And with all due respect to most of the major talent agencies, not a single one of them has a new talent division because they only interested in new talent when it's hot. So where do all those people go? Now, the film festival circuit has been a marvelous and somewhat extraordinary avenue for young filmmakers and new filmmakers to be able to go. But if you're going to a film festival, that means you've raised the money and you've made your movie. So for all those people who are at the stages before that, where can you have a place to expose your work? Where can you have a place to have it looked at, have it talked about? And so we created TriggerStreet.com. My business partner and I, Dana Brunetti, looked at this and decided that the Internet was a fantastic place to go to.
Kevin Spacey is my guest, and that new website he's talking about is called TriggerStreet.com, and his new movie, which opens February 22nd, is The Life of David Gale. I want to ask you about one of your two Academy Award-winning roles, and that's for American Beauty, which I think is such a fantastic film, and it was such a great performance. Let me just play a short scene from the movie, and this is the scene in which you're at the dinner table with your family, and you're talking to your teenage daughter and your wife. Your daughter's telling you how her day was. Your day's been pretty awful. Here's the conversation.
So, Janie, how was school?
It was okay.
Just okay?
No, Dad. It was spectacular.
Well, you want to know how things went at my job today? They've hired this efficiency expert, this really friendly guy named Brad. How perfect is that? And he's basically there to make it seem like they're justified in firing somebody because they couldn't just come right out and say that, could they? No, no, that would just be too honest. And so they've asked us, you couldn't possibly care less, could you?
Well, what do you expect? You can't all of a sudden be my best friend just because you had a bad day. I mean, hello. You've barely even spoken to me for months.
Kevin Spacey, that was such a great character, and I love the way you do your lines in this movie and in all of your roles. This character has a really biting wit, very sarcastic, very ironic, but somehow that seems to all be coming out of a position of weakness, because he's kind of weak at home, he's weak at work. Can you talk a little bit about mixing that kind of weakness and strength that he has, the strength to lash out, but the weakness that it's coming from?
Well, so much of a performance like in American Beauty, it has everything to do with your relationship with the director. Because if you just think about what it's like to make a movie versus what it's like to do a play.
Sure.
Well, I always look at it this way, or at least I have since I directed, because I really understood the importance of it for the actor, to try to come onto the set of each scene and to be able to give the director as many different colors as possible, so that when the director goes into the editing room, he or she has choices. For example, if you only say a line with a kind of snarly, sardonic, that's all he's ever going to be able to choose. But if you give him four or five different takes, you know, maybe one or two, you go, you know, that really sounded right. Why don't you do that again? Try that. Try it with that degree of, or Sam would come up and whisper in my ear and say, I want you to be angry, but I don't want you to frighten them.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you just get little sort of pearls of how to approach each time you do a take, so that they have choice. So that very often, you know, tone of how a line is delivered, speed, facial expression, all goes into every single second in a film, builds an audience's belief and understanding of a character. And so if you only give, for example, a director one thing, or, you know, sometimes we go to movies and it seems like the actor has just been in one speed, you know, and they're playing the same thing throughout the movie. Let's say they're just playing anger for the whole movie.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
More than likely, they got convinced that that was the place they ought to go to, and they stayed with it the whole way, and they didn't have a director of the kind of skill who could keep asking them to shift. And sometimes shifts in a minimal direction can change a scene.
Can I take a specific line? And I'm not going to get this exactly, but the line was, okay, Jane, you want to know how my day was?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a lot of different ways of doing that before?
Yeah, absolutely. And then what you find, I mean, I don't go to dailies. And dailies, for those who don't know what they are, the film you shot the day before, they print and look at the next day. So they get a chance to see how the film is coming along, and they, you know, the director can pick favorite takes and, mm-hmm. you know, that he knows he wants to have in editing. Well, I don't go. And I stopped going, really, to dailies on Usual Suspects at the request of the director. Which was a very, very good request on that film, because I had to play so many different levels. He didn't want me to second guess it. But what that ended up leading to was a desire of mine not to go at all after that, because I can't second guess how it's coming across. And therefore, I'm kind of free, and I put myself in the hands of the director, and I trust their guidance, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's been the right decision for me. Sometimes, you know, you're working with a director of less skill, and you know, that's how the cookie crumbles. But 9 times out of 10, the most sort of thrilling part of the post-production process is when I go and I see a cut of the movie for the first time, and I have no memory of a particular take because I never saw it before. I have no thought. I have no idea what they used or how they did it. And I marvel at it. And in a particular case with American Beauty, there's a really interesting story that illustrates how that can be liberating. We were shooting on the set, and we must have been maybe 10 weeks into shooting the film. And Sam came to me one afternoon, and he said, you know, I need to go upstairs with you and just a little tape recorder and record a guide track for the editor of all the voiceover you do through the whole movie. And I said, oh, okay, great. So I don't even remember what day this was. We went upstairs at 9 o'clock that night when I had a break, and we sat in a little room with a very noisy hallway and a little tiny tape recorder, and I laid down, after Sam gave me a little bit of direction, all the narration that happens in the course of the film. And then, I don't know, 6-7 months later, Sam showed me the movie. And he looked at me and he said, do you want to re-record the narration? And I went, you mean that's it? Oh, that's right. I never went into a studio and recorded it. And so Sam used this little, you know, cassette recording, because what happened is that the performance was so easy because I hadn't seen the movie. I had no idea what images were going to go with that narration. And Sam used it, you know, much to the chagrin to some degree with the sound designers, but they managed to make it work. And I said I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, because I'm sure if I'd gone back into a studio setting and I'd seen the movie, I would have dramatized it. I would have known the impact it would have. And that's just a great illustration of how great it is sometimes when you don't know, and when you just trust the material and you do what the job is, and later on you can suddenly realize that it had an effortlessness to it that I don't think we could have recreated if I tried to record it later on.
My guest is Kevin Spacey. Here's some of his narration from the film American Beauty.
My name is Lester Burnham. This is my neighborhood. This is my street. This is my life. I'm 42 years old. In less than a year, I'll be dead. Of course, I don't know that yet. And in a way, I'm dead already.
A few things about your life. Your father was, what, a technical writer? Did
yeah,
he
they,
aviation
call, yeah they called him a technical procedure writer. Mm-hmm. And essentially, he worked a lot in the aircraft industry. So I've described it that the sort of easiest way that people can sort of glom onto it is that if you were building the F-16, my father would have written the manual to tell you how to do it. So as dry, technical kind of writing as you can imagine. And unhappily, I mean, it wasn't a job he cherished. And what he really did at night, and what he did in all of his time off from the time that I can remember, was he was trying to be a creative writer, and he was writing the great American novel.
No, correct me if I'm wrong, but I read that he left behind when he died novels and stories that he'd written that you didn't know existed.
Absolutely, because he never showed us anything. It wasn't good enough.
Well, I can't imagine what it was like to read those novels that you didn't even know existed.
It was like finding a different person. It was like, you know, it was unfortunate that my father never felt it was good enough to show anybody or try to get published, because it was good enough. And it was a kind of remarkable journey for me. And I still have some of the stuff I'm still going through, because he wrote a lot.
Wow.
I mean, volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes. And he also did this remarkable amount of research on names, like people's names and places, and had the origins of the names and history of names. I mean, if I ever need, you know, character names, I know right where to go.
Since he clearly would have liked to live the writer's life and not the writer who writes the technical manuals, but the novelist, did he emotionally approve of your choice to be an actor, to make your art your profession?
Yeah, I think he, you know, he lived long enough to see that I was beginning to work. I mean, the last thing I was doing when he passed, it was after Lost in Yonkers, and it was after I did Glengarry Glen Ross. So he really knew that I was sort of, you know, trying to build a career for myself, and he was terribly excited, as was my mother. They used to come to all the performances from the time I was in junior high of practically everything I did, and were enormously supportive about it. And I think my father instilled in me, as did the earliest teachers that I had, a love of writing, of the craft of it, and of story. And that's really what's driven me in terms of the kind of choices that I make as an actor. I am more enamored of the writer and the process of how difficult it is and how magical it is, I think, because I had one in my family.
You were born in New Jersey, moved to Los Angeles when you were about four.
Right.
Did it have an impact on you one way or another to grow up in the capital of the industry?
No, because my family wasn't involved in it at all. I mean, the closest I got was sneaking into Universal Studios when I was about 14 years old.
How'd you sneak in?
Oh, I used to sneak in the back. It's now, obviously, for a lot of reasons in our country, become much more difficult to sneak into a place like Universal. But I sure did have a lot of fun when I was there shooting K-Pax, you know, remembering how, you know, I'd slap a hammer on the side of my buckle and sort of walk in very early in the morning and look like a worker. And you know, just waved to the guard, and it was in a more innocent time.
Wait, what would you do once you got in?
I'd wander around. I'd watch things. I remember watching Kojak shoot. I remember watching McMillan and Wife shoot. I remember watching all kinds of movies. You know, I just was sort of hanging around on sets, and then every now and then somebody would ask me to do something.
Like hammer something?
Yeah, like, hey, come over here. Help me. And I'd make up some story. I was here visiting somebody, and suddenly you'd be moving something. And then, you know, after a while, people kind of get to know your face. And I did it for quite a while. It was really kind of remarkable to be that young, and I was, you know, I was drawn to movies, and the whole idea of it was really exciting.
Did you have a plan in mind about what you were going to do if somebody found out that you were really an imposter and you didn't work there?
No, I hadn't even thought it through. I just thought if you look like you belong, then, you know, maybe you'll get by.
And I did. An early lesson in acting?
An early lesson in acting.
Fooling all the other actors.
I'm still looking like I belong.
What were the movies when you were a kid that you watched over and over again, either in the theaters or on TV, or the lines or the monologues that you memorized and would do for friends?
There's a theater in Los Angeles called the New Art Theater, which is in Santa Monica, and they still do to this day. But at the time, they had all these remarkable programs where you could go and see, the works of European films. You could see Peter Brook's King Lear, Eraserhead, Harold and Maude, you know, all of these movies that were really remarkable in their scope and kind of exciting because they weren't the movies that were, you know, out in the movie theaters. So I used to watch those a lot. They used to have, they don't anymore, but of course now with cable we have so many more channels to watch, but at the time I remember the late movie, and then the late later movie, and, you know, little did I know then how much those films are being desecrated by pan and scan and you know, internal cutting and all kinds of other things. But for me, you know, kind of innocently, really watching the great actors, Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart and Spencer Tracy and, you know, Cary Grant and all of those incredible films that they made. And, of course, you know, then watching them again later as my life went on, and realizing the seriousness of some of those subjects and studying a little bit about them as actors and people. So I kind of grew up in a world in which I was paying attention to a sort of different generation than the one that was currently working. You know, while all my friends were talking about the people currently, I was sort of going, yeah, but did you ever see Henry Fonda in The Lady Eve? You know? So I kind of grew up with this being drawn to actors of that generation.
Do you think that influenced your acting at all?
I absolutely believe it did.
How do you think it did?
I think I talk faster than most actors today.
Huh.
I mean, if you go back and you look at the movies, just thinking of it technically, think about how fast, you know, even though he had the stutter, think about how fast Jimmy Stewart, Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, Tracy, they talked fast. They weren't feeling every moment. They weren't, you know, evoking every emotion. They were just doing their job and moving on. And so there is a speed to the way in which they gave performances that I just have enormous admiration for, because they just got on with it. We have a lot of actors who really take their time, really want us to know how hard they're working. And I just think, just get on with it. So I have and also I think coming out of the theater, you know, you learn in the theater that you've got to get a mouthful out very quickly to keep a theater audience focused on what they're supposed to be focused on, especially if it's a long and complicated play. So I think just on that level it was probably an influence. And then I remember there was a whole series of wonderful performances that were done at the Music Center in Los Angeles when I was 14, 13 years old, and I went and saw Katharine Hepburn do A Matter of Gravity, and Richard Thomas do St. Joan, Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau, Maureen Stapleton do Juno and the Peacock. In fact, that's where I first met Jack Lemmon, signed a photo for me at a seminar what we did as kids.
Gee, I love what you're saying about the older actors talking more quickly and just kind of getting on with it. Because, I mean, one of the first things I think about when I think about your performances is your voice and the way you do lines, because there's such a rhythm and energy in that that's just captivating, you know.
Well, I also believe that you have to let the audience do half the work for you. You know, I feel very often that films that don't do that, you know, they just go by and I don't even remember them. You know, it's like I like to do films that I think, well, there's two sort of criteria for me. One is, does this film stand a chance of a second viewing? And I love the idea that you watch, because I used to love to watch films again and again and again, and you get more out of it every time you see it. That's a big criteria. And the other for me is just, does it have a reasonable shot at standing the test of time? Will this movie be around in 50 years?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Spacey, and his new movie is called The Life of David Gale. It opens February 21st. He also has a new website, by the way, called TriggerStreet.com, in which he's showcasing the work of young filmmakers, their shorts. You know, you're talking about liking older movies when you were growing up and liking the work of James Cagney and Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda, Katharine Hepburn. Each actor that you mentioned has such a distinctive voice that these were the actors that all the Impressionists would copy. And I know that you're a good mimic because, you know, I saw you on Saturday Night Live doing Christopher Walken, and that was so funny. That was so great. What were you hearing in his voice? I mean, because part of what you do as an actor is hear different talking styles and try to get the style you need for a role. What did you hear in his voice? Can you talk a little bit about how you listened?
I might even use an example because I know it better than Walken, because the Walken thing on Saturday Night Live actually happened so fast. I didn't do a Walken impression. I mean, I'd never done one. And my friends do one, and I marvel at it because they're so good at it. And they're much better than I am, by the way. But we decided on late Tuesday night that we were going to write this sketch about the never-before-unseen screen test for Star Wars. And we thought it was a very funny idea to do Walken. So I watched Walken movies for 2 days and then got on the phone with my friends and literally filmed that thing on Friday morning before you went live on Saturday. But let me use an example of like William Hurt, who people know from Broadcast News and Kiss of the Spider-Woman. I had the opportunity to understudy in Hurley Burley when he was doing it on Broadway. And what I found always fascinating about the way Bill Hurt spoke was it always seemed to me like it was painful for him to speak. That there was some kind of effort in moving his mouth and making you understand his point of view. And it was almost like the way in which he breathed was difficult. You know, that breath itself is a effort. And
so perfect.
It always... and I use him because it's, you know, people used to say to me, nobody does Bill Hurt, you know. And I kind of love that, you know, when you find somebody that's really interesting to do. I actually did him on Saturday Night Live, and I saw him years later after I did it. He goes, yeah, I saw that funny program you did. That was humorous. But I really love doing people that aren't sort of, you know, I mean, a lot of people now do Walken because it's so fun to do him. I really, when I grew up, I just had this, I had an ear. And I guess if it doesn't sound right to me, then I know it's wrong. And in a way, I think that same aspect of how I've learned to do impressions, I think works on me as an actor.
How? What's the connection?
Well, I think that it's very important to me how things sound. Not just in terms of logic, but grammar. You know, sometimes I'll specifically say something and I know it's not the right grammar, but it does the rhythm of a line, the musicality of a writer. You know, in plays, it's much more golden. You know, you're not going to touch a writer's work in a play as much as you're going to touch writing in film, because film is such a different medium, and it's so much a visual medium that it's almost important what you don't say.
Can you think of a line that it just didn't sound right to you and you fixed it?
Yeah, I mean, there are times when a line, it feels like it wants to have a rhythm, but there isn't enough there, so you have to put handles on it. You have to find a way to, you know, instead of the line being, I'm just going to make something up, but instead of a line being, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? It could be, listen, let me tell you something. You know what I'm talking about. If you sometimes put a handle on it, it gives you a sort of a better way into a line, or it gives the line more weight, or it adds a rhythm to it, a musicality to it that wasn't there. I'm always looking for that, and when I find it in material, particularly playwrights who write in a slightly different rhythmic pattern and repeat things on purpose. There's a big reason why that happens.
Can you think of an example?
Well, O'Neill repeats a great deal in his plays, you know, where not only does he repeat lines of dialogue that you say again in a slightly different way, but characters in his life repeat. There's so much of Jamie from Long Day's Journey in Hickey in Iceman Cometh that you almost can see the correlation of where he drew from his own brother. But dialogue that, you know, you are trying to find. Sometimes I often will fight to cut lines in movies because I think that it's already understood. You know, you don't have to say it because the audience already understands it by the visual that you're trying to give them in terms of expressions and decisions and choices that characters make. So very often I'm fighting to get rid of dialogue because I feel it's unnecessary and it doesn't advance the story. It actually just repeats something that the audience already knows.
My guest is Kevin Spacey. Here's the sketch from Saturday Night Live in which Spacey plays Christopher Walken auditioning for a role in Star Wars.
Christopher Walken, Han Solo screen test. Okay, Chris, whenever you're ready.
I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed, if it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon.
Did I?
It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. She's fast enough for you, old man. That sucked. I'm sorry. I need a minute.
Something else I read about you, that when you were young, tell me if you don't mind talking about this, that you set fire to a shed in the backyard of your house. And I don't know if too much has been made about this or not, but but I'm wondering what it was, what inspired it, and what it was like for you to watch the flames.
Oh, I think in most kids' lives you go through a little rambunctious period, and I think that the really the thing that's only been made most of that is that, you know, then I start reading stories about me having been this really troubled kid and, you know, terrorizing the neighborhood and, you know, this and that. And in fact, you know, I did a couple of things that got me in trouble, and that was one of them. And then my father quickly carted us off to military school because he wouldn't have it. And after that, I found theater. So that sort of part of my life, but it was really like a, you know, a sort of a year of my life where I was in that stage where, you know, I was between the ages of, you know, sort of 8 and 10.
Now, what about military school? How well did you fit in there?
Didn't like it. Didn't stay. Wasn't for me.
Get anything from it as an actor from the career military men who taught there or from the other students, a type?
No, because I wasn't paying attention to it in that level. It wasn't until after that I started taking a theater class. So it just was a... I don't tend to be violent, you know. If I'm pushed, then I'll protect myself. But it was just it felt like a very violent atmosphere. And what got me thrown out of there was a fight, so...
Did you pick it or someone beat on you?
I defended myself.
Against?
Somebody who was picking a fight with me.
For?
Well, they used to do this weird thing, which is if two people got into some kind of argument in class or tussle or whatever, they'd actually stop school. They'd take everybody out of their classes. They'd bring everybody out to the football field, and they had a ring of tires, like a little ring, and then they'd put boxing gloves on you, and you'd have to fight it out.
So,
kind of interesting. So, while we were watching some other fight going on, I got into a fight with somebody around the ring, and I picked up one of the tires, and I threw it on the guy, and I think I injured his shoulder, and then I got kicked out of school. You know, but that also happened the same week I won the leadership medal, so I still haven't quite figured all that out.
Lucky break to get thrown out of school?
Very lucky break, yeah.
And you, this was at high school?
No, junior high. And then it was right after that a guidance counselor suggested that I take a drama class. And
why do you think they suggested that? What did
because
they?
Because I said, because I think there they were looking at my, you know, my deviant record at military school and thinking, thank God it was somebody who had the sensitivity to say, maybe you have some excessive amount of energy that you need to try to parlay into something that's more productive. So how about woodshop? How about this? How about giving you an activity? And I don't know, you know, whether I was, you know, attention deficit syndrome at that age or what, but I was a firecracker, and I can tell you, I remember the moment that I gave a performance on stage in this class for the first time and people applauded. And it was literally like a bell went off over my head, and I remember just turning and looking out and thinking, what in the heck is that? Feeling for the first time I fit in.
No, you've talked about doing impressions, and I know you do a good Carson impression. Tell me if I have this wrong, but I think when you were in your teens, you at least once pretended to be Johnny Carson's son.
Mm-hmm.
To get a good seat at a restaurant?
No, actually, it was to get into a nightclub.
Oh.
And, you know, I just did sort of a slight variation on Carson so it wasn't so obvious. And we got in. We got in. We got champagne. And I thank Johnny to this day for that. I used to also sometimes be able to get tickets to The Tonight Show, because while I was studying, I was going to the show every night and just sort of watching it, because you learn so much about a performer watching them live versus watching them on television. It's a very different aspect, and I learned a great deal, and he was so much fun to do. And you know, I did the show once before he retired. I had done a television film, a rather campy television film about Jim and Tammy Baker.
Oh, yeah.
With Bernadette Peters, and he'd had such a field day with them for a couple, you know, 2 years of monologue jokes that he was kind of excited to have me on. And he had been shown a tape of my impression of him and was actually going to let me do it on the program. But we ran out of time. It just turned out that I ended up being the last guest, and I had about a minute and 30 seconds, you know, for a clip and a little conversation. But it was thrilling for me to have finally made it on that program, because I miss Johnny Carson.
Yeah. Did you feel guilty at all when you were pretending to be his son?
Absolutely not. You know, if it doesn't harm anybody, and you know, look, it goes back to my days of you know, trying to sneak into Universal or any of the other things that, you know, look, we've all done it in our lives, you know, where you've sort of tried to get in somewhere you weren't supposed to be. And as long as it's a harmless thing, and, you know, I think people do what they can. I mean, I've seen it. There are times when I'm on a film set and I can tell when somebody doesn't belong there. And if they're, you know, young enough and they don't look like they're, you know, stalker material, you know, you just leave them alone, you know, because that's an experience that, you know, if they're not harming anybody, then it's okay. You know, it's all right. It's a little harder in our world now, but I think there's something kind of interesting about people that sort of find a way, if they're not being obnoxious, you know, to sort of get in.
What's the most interesting thing you've ever done to get an acting job at an audition?
Well, the one that I've told this story before, because it's the one that ended up really, for me, changing my life. I read in the New York Times 1 year that Jack Lemmon was coming back to Broadway to do Long Day's Journey and Tonight, and I turned to my friend who I was having breakfast with, and I said, I'm going to play Jamie in that production. And my friend said, you are? And I said, you bet I am. And he said, when did you audition? And I said, I haven't yet, but I'm going to. And I spent about 8 months trying to get an audition for that play, and I could not get in that door. I wasn't right. They wanted the big name. And by the way, I wasn't, you know, I was understudying Hurley Burley at this point, so I was at least working. I had a legitimate job. And I found out that Jonathan Miller, who was going to direct the production, is a wonderful director and doctor and original comedian with Beyond the Fringe in Britain. He was coming over to do a series of lectures at the Juilliard, the Alice Tully Hall. And I got tickets for this event. And I sat in that audience on the first night, because I knew he'd be auditioning that week. I knew that was it. That was the last chance at the gate. And he gave this fantastic lecture on the afterlife of plays. And the whole time I'm just sitting there thinking, you know, how am I going to meet him? What am I going to do? Am I going to go backstage and say, hi, I want to audition for your play? So I went back the second night because I couldn't figure out a way to meet him the first night. And sitting next to me was a very elderly citizen. And in fact, she was asleep through most of the lecture. She was elegantly dressed. And I looked down and sticking out of her purse was an invitation to a cocktail reception in honor of Dr. Miller. And I thought, you know, Well, you know, she looked tired, you know, and the chances of her going were really slim, I thought. And plus, she probably could get in anyway without the invitation, you know. So I took it, and I moved seats very quickly. And then I went to this place where they had all these tables out, and I sat by the bar and had a couple of drinks and tried to reserve my nerve to go over and talk to Dr. Miller, who was sitting at a table with Kurt Vonnegut on one side and Norman Mailer on the other, and, you know, all these people. And finally Kurt Vonnegut got up and staggered away to the men's room and didn't come back, and I beelined for that chair, and I sat down with Dr. Miller, and we had this lovely conversation, and I was very charming and blah, blah, blah. And he finally said the greatest opening I could have hoped for, which is, what brought you to my lecture? And I said, Eugene O'Neill. And he said, is he here? I've always wanted to meet him. And I told him that I'd been trying to audition for the play for 8 months, and that the American casting directors felt he wanted movie stars, and all I wanted was 5 minutes, and I felt I was at the right age to play Jack's son, and I loved the play, and it had been one of the most incredible plays I'd ever read. And he wrote down the hotel he was at, and 2 days later I had an audition, and later on, about 4 months later, I had to audition with Jack, and I got the part.
Were you nervous at those auditions?
You bet. Although I was also I was nervous, but I'd also never gone out on a limb quite the way I had to try to get an audition for that play. And one of the things that I had learned a lesson about, and I'm really glad I learned it, was I had a manager early in my career, and I was, you know, like a lot of young actors when you start out, I was just angry that I wasn't auditioning for everything everybody else was auditioning for. Why aren't I up for this? Why aren't I up for that? And so I heard a movie's coming in town, and he finally stopped me one day and he said, let me ask you a question. Do you know anything about this movie? Do you know anything about this part? I mean, just because so-and-so is auditioning for it doesn't necessarily mean it's right for you. You better make a decision in your life that if you're going to go fight for something, you know what you're fighting for. Because otherwise you'll lose your credibility. And it just looks like you're ambitious, fight for everything. So that was a really great lesson that I finally learned, that when I fight for something, I know what I'm fighting for. And I knew I was fighting for that role because I knew I was right for it, and I did my work. So I walked into that audition absolutely determined. And I remember there was this incredible moment that I will never forget. We did about 4 scenes, Jack Lemmon and I was relentless with him. I mean, I toppled over his lines and I drove through his pauses and you know, because the character of Jamie is a very angry with his father. They have a difficult relationship. And at the end of the audition, Jack walked up to me and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, you know what? I never thought I'd find the rotten kid, but you're it. Jesus Christ, what the hell was that? And thank God, because Jack really had the decision about, you know, who was going to play the boys. And so Peter Gallagher and I played Jamie and Edmund. And the chance to work with a man who was at the top of his profession for so long, the way in which he conducted himself, the leadership role he took with the company, all of that, I think, had a deep and forever imprinted an impression on me about how I wanted to conduct myself.
You have such a verbal skill as a performer, the rhythms, the focus, the energy. Is that something you've always felt confident about in life as well? You know, when you don't have a script.
No. I understand, you know, in certain circumstances what the function is, and so I'm able to go for it. Like, you know, if I do a David Letterman show or a, you know, I understand what that show is. That's a comedy program.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you got to be funny and you got to tell anecdotal stories and you got to leave a couple of openings for the host to get a couple of great zingers in. And if you understand the function, then you can go on there and have a good time. And I do. I have a great time. But it's a performance, you know. There is a performance aspect to it. But there are many places where I don't feel comfortable and many places where I don't have a script and where I think, God, what the hell am I going to say? And that's the moments where you really love and respect writing so much. You know, I wish I was as, you know, witty and clever and have such a verbal skill as some of the characters I play. But I don't.
We're pretty good anyways.
Well, you know, I've picked up a little along the way.
Kevin Spacey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kevin Spacey's new film, The Life of David Gale, opens next month. His new website is called TriggerStreet.com. He's in the early stages of putting together a movie based on the life of Bobby Darin, in which he'll portray the singer. Here's Bobby Darin's biggest hits.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning,
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Be Mac the knife. There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know?